Okay, the Public Safety Finance Division will come to order. We don't quite have a quorum yet. So what we're going to do today, I don't know how long this will take, and I don't know what motions are in order here, Representative Hillstrom, but we have a number of your, well, a number of members' bills that are going to be rolled into, I guess, sort of an omnibus domestic violence bill. So, but I also, so, and that is, I guess you would want to move House File 2608 first. Would that be the correct motion?
That's correct. Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 2608 be recommended pass and be placed on the general register. I believe it has to go back up to finance. Okay. So I guess it would be.
And then you'll be making amendments to this bill. Is that the way I understand it?
Correct, Mr. Chair. I will be moving the DE2 amendment. And basically, the goal was to consolidate some of these domestic violence bills so we didn't have to take them up day after day after day on the House floor.
Right.
And so I've been talking with members and collecting the domestic violence bills, and that's what the DE2 amendment will be, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to walk through that if you'd like me to move.
Okay, let's first take up the House File 2608. Is there any discussion on this bill? All those in favor of adopting House File 2608 with a referral to finance.
Mr. Chair, I think we have to amend that first. Or are you sending each an individual bill alone
why don't we do your amendment first, yes, and then we'll get it. Okay.
Correct, Mr. Chair. Okay, so Mr. Chair, I have the DE2 amendment, and what that does is that keeps House File 2608, which extends the area of protection for reasonable areas surrounding the residence.
Wait, okay. Good catch, Dennis. That's why you're here.
We do have a quorum.
Okay. Okay. I just want to make sure. Okay, we do have a quorum. We can't count today, Dennis. It's not working.
Summer.
We're dealing with budget numbers all night, so okay. Okay, so we do have a quorum, but we don't have the amendment.
The amendment is coming?
Yes. So why don't you talk briefly about each bill, and then as the when the amendment comes. Representative Hillstrom, you want to just go through each bill or amendment? And
certainly, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Chair, House File 2608 extends the area for protection to a reasonable area surrounding the residence. House File 3361 is Representative Holberg's bill, and that exempts certain domestic abuse or sexual attack programs from the data practice requirements and classifying of data. Mr. Chair, also House File 3383, which also is Representative Holberg's bill, which establishes data classification for private, for vehicle information in orders for protection or no contact orders. And then, Mr. Chair, your bill, House File 1396, which authorizes the courts to include animals and companion animals in protective orders. Your bill also, Mr. Chair, House File 3089, which increases the maximum for bail for non-felony domestic abuse offenses. It expands the tampering with a witness crime. It clarifies the requirements that data communication networks include orders for protection and no contact orders. I believe, Mr. Chair, those are the only bills that we're going to be putting in this DE2 amendment.
Okay, so Representative Hillstrom, now the amendments, the DE2 amendment is being passed out, and the DE2 amendment makes some minor changes, and that also deals with some of the cost of the bill. Is that correct?
Yes, correct, Mr. Chair. The stalking bill ended up having a fiscal cost as well as, I believe, one other, and so we made some technical changes to get the fiscal cost down to zero.
Do you want to just tell us what those changes are that you got down to zero?
How about we have a testifier come down and tell you what changes were made to get it down to zero?
All right. Good morning. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Liz Richards with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. Chair, the changes that were made to the stalking bill, a couple of things. There was a fiscal note that had to do with the pattern of offense list of crimes that could go into the pattern of stalking, and it was based on the addition of the first, second, and third degree assault charges to that list of crimes, and because they were felonies, that drew a potential fiscal note. And so we've actually eliminated that from the list of additional patterned offenses. So the expansion of underlying crimes that could be part of the pattern now includes homicide and then the misdemeanors, interference with a 911 call, some of the lower level ones, and the other felony charges that were in the pattern were dropped. The other was under the elements of the offense, it references harassment. It creates talked about if there was harassment that fell under the stalking type behaviors. That was an addition that drew a fiscal note that's been eliminated from the stalking statute as well.
Mr. Chair, I believe that
Hillstrom.
I believe that Ms. Perius also has an oral technical amendment to fix.
Ms. Perius?
Mr. Chair, members, one of the harassment crime that Ms. Richards just mentioned didn't actually make it out of this version, so I'm going to amend it to reflect the author's intent.
What page are you on?
On page 7, line 33. So on page 7, line 33, reinstate the or. On page 7, lines 34 and 35, delete that new language. And then on page 8, line 1, delete the number 8 in parentheses. And then there are a few cross-references that will need to be changed, and I believe we can just direct the reviser to update the cross-references to reflect this change.
Okay. Does everyone understand the oral amendment that Representative Hillstrom is offering that Ms. Perius just explained? All those in favor of the oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Now, Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, I believe you need to adopt the DE2 amendment, and so I would make that motion.
Representative Hillstrom moves the DE2 amendment. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Now, Representative Hillstrom.
And then, Mr. Chair, I would move that House file 2608 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Finance Committee as amended.
Is there any discussion on that motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Now,
thank
your next,
you, Mr. Chair.
Your next bill is House file.
It would be House file 2990, Mr. Chair.
2990. Does everyone have that? This is the guardian ad litem bill.
Mr. Chair, the pseudocell is on her way. She has not yet arrived.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to explain the bill, or do you want to wait for Ms. DeSalle to come?
I can, Mr. Chair, and then if we get too many hard questions.
Do you want to take your other bill first?
I'm fine with taking the other bill first, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Janet Marshall testify to it, or would you prefer to wait for Ms. DeSalle?
I think she left the room. I think she left the room to get Ms. DeSalle.
Okay. Is there anyone that wants to testify on House File 2990? There is. Okay. Okay. Just hold on 1 second. Well, why don't we take 2990 afterwards? Why don't we do your other bill first?
Okay. All right, Mr. Chair. I would move that this committee lays over House File 3081 for possible inclusion in a public safety omnibus bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Very good. Representative Hillstrom, do you want to introduce your bill and we're testifiers?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, House File 3081 is the governor's initiative, and it increases the penalty for criminal sexual conduct. And with me is Harry Kennedy with the department, and I would like him to say a few words,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kennedy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3081 seeks to double the presumptive sentence for criminal sexual conduct first-degree crimes from 12 years to 25 years. And CSC 1 offenses involve anger rapists, other violent offenders, and predators who rape children. And 8 years spent in a DOC facility under the current sentencing structure is not enough. And this bill will appropriately address the damage, the physical and emotional scars left by these crimes, and appropriately the sentence will address those crimes.
So, that's your testimony, okay.
I believe that's the end of our testimony, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there anyone else that would like to testify either for or against this bill or add some comments? Please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gerald Kaplan. I'm the executive director of Alpha Human Services, which we have three sex offender treatment programs. The residential program is the only adult community-based inpatient sex offender program certified and licensed by the Department of Corrections in Minnesota. We also have outpatient programs for adults and adolescents. I'm a licensed psychologist. I have over 35 years of experience in assessing and treating criminal sex offenders. Before the parole board was disbanded in 1981, I was a consultant to the parole board and evaluated all dangerous and violent offenders and criminal sex offenders prior to parole board hearings. I've also done civil commitment examinations in Hennepin, Anoka, and Rice counties. In 2004-2005, I was on Governor Pawlenty's Commission on Sex Offender Policy, and we produced a comprehensive set of recommendations in 2005. The purpose of my testimony today is not to advocate for shorter sentences for sex offenders. I'm here to advocate for a comprehensive review and reworking of the criminal sexual conduct statutes. For the last 5 years, and if not longer, there's been a patchwork approach to changing or lengthening sentences for sex offenders. Some cases there's been enhanced penalties, in other cases there's been indeterminate sentences. The result of this piecemeal approach, I think, has resulted in unnecessary complexity in the statutes and, to a large extent, the loss of some kind of rational cohesiveness in our sex offender statutes. At the same time, changes in policy have not always taken into consideration the information and data that's been collected in regard to recidivism and sex offender management by the Minnesota Department of Corrections. I think House File 3081 is an example of this piecemeal approach, which would not be productive. This provision does not just apply to stranger-on-stranger sexual assault or violent sexual assaults, or assaults with a dangerous weapon. I agree that those are some of the worst offenses. Rape of a child who's a stranger probably is the worst offense, worst sex offense that could occur. But it also includes the 90% of child sexual abusers, or 90% of the child sexual abuse cases in which the offender is known to the child, often family, friend, or relative. It also includes 80% of the child sexual abuse cases in which the engagement strategy was a manipulative strategy and not a physically coercive or aggressive strategy. It also includes a 16-year-old who had a sexual relationship with a consenting partner who was a few months short of his or her 13th birthday. Does it make sense to send that 16-year-old to prison for 25 years, 18 months less than someone convicted of second-degree murder? It also includes the 20-year-old supervisor at a fast food restaurant who has a consensual relationship with another worker who is a few months short of his or her 16th birthday. Does it make sense to send that 20-year-old to prison for 25 years, a sentence which is considerably longer than third-degree murder? This lack of proportionality, I think, is a significant problem. The proposed statute does not address the issue of risk of reoffense. Some offenders who have committed first-degree criminal sexual conduct offenses are not as sexually attached to the deviant outlet as others that may have been convicted of fourth-degree criminal sexual conduct. The risk of reoffense should be an issue in how long a person should be incapacitated through incarceration. Some facts. Minnesota has been very effective in its supervision and management of sex offenders. The vast majority of sex offenders released from prison do not reoffend. The word on the street is almost all reoffend. In fact, the reoffense rate is about 5%. Even level 3 offenders, those that are most likely to reoffend, are reoffending at a 5% rate because of treatment, intensive supervision, and identifying the worst of the offenders for civil commitment. The vast majority of sex offenses are not committed by reoffenders. On average, in a given year, 90 to 92% of adjudications are those without a true prior sex crime conviction. Only 8 to 10% that are being adjudicated have a true prior sex offense conviction. So if you take a look at the reoffense rates, you could extrapolate and say, you know, we can keep one person who would reoffend in prison for another 13 years, while at the same time we keep another 19 in prison for another 13 years. 19 who would not reoffend for 13 years. I also can't understand how the argument can be made that there isn't a fiscal impact with doubling the presumptive sentence, more than doubling the presumptive sentence under this proposed legislation. When I started working in corrections, there were 2 prisons for adult males. Now there's 6. I believe that this will take the same course as civil commitment. 21 years ago, there were 50 civilly committed sex offenders at the security hospital in St. Peter. No one got out until they died, and then a few people would be added. That's when, 21 years ago, was when the modern era of civil commitment of sex offenders began, when the Honeywell parking ramp murder of Mary Foley by David Thomas. It was 10 years before there was much discussion about the high cost, projected high cost of civil commitment and concerns about that, and the Minnesota legislature was concerned about these projected costs of civil commitment. Everyone knows about the explosion of civil commitment since the murder of Drew Shedin by Alfonso Rodriguez. Now there's 570 civilly committed sex offenders, and for good reason. There's great concern currently about the cost that's associated with maintaining the Minnesota Sex Offender Treatment Program for civilly committed sex offenders. Of course, the costs are going to begin to escalate after 12 years if next August we start sentencing people to 25 years in prison for their first offense. This is also being sold as a way to eliminate civil commitment. Well, for the next 12 years, we're still going to be civilly committing people. And even after that, not all of the people that are being civilly committed have been convicted of criminal sexual conduct in the first degree. There are many individuals that have been convicted of lesser degrees. And the reason for that is a major part of the decision to civilly commit somebody is risk of reoffense, not necessarily the severity level of the offense. This proposed statute lengthens the sentence only on the severity level of the offense and not on the risk of reoffending or the risk to the community. I'm not asking you to shorten sex offender sentences. No one wants to have their next election opponent claim that they're soft on crime. I'm asking you to table this and other proposed sex offender legislation in favor of lengthening sentences for the worst sex offenders and those that are most likely to reoffend. I'm asking you to reject this shotgun approach that lumps all first-degree sex offenders together without allowing for discretion after sentencing. I'm asking you to support the idea of comprehensive, rational reworking of sex offender statutes based on the empirical data that's available to the Department of Corrections and the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. I'm asking you to support the reestablishment of a commission similar to the 2004-2005 Governor's Sex Offender Policy Commission, which was truly a bipartisan commission. Lastly, I'm asking you to read the report that was produced by the Governor's Commission in 2005. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised by the sensible sentencing and release system which was proposed by this hardworking bipartisan group of experts.
Thank you, Mr. Kaplan. Any questions of Mr. Kaplan? Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. I would ask members, we should really make this available. I mean, this is the, I should have known about it. I don't know if anyone else did. I never read it until recently, just now. But the Governor's Commission on Sex Offender Policy that was completed in 2005, Mr. Kaplan was a member of that. And there are some really excellent recommendations here because I think we realize this legislative session that we've got a huge problems on our hand. I think we saw that play out over the whole debate over the expansion at MSLP. You know, we've got this bill. We've got a bill in the Senate that adds indeterminate sentencing. I think we have a major problem, and I agree with Mr. Kaplan that we really need to look at this in a comprehensive manner and do what's right to preserve public safety in this state while not breaking the bank. And I was planning on offering an amendment to the bill that would have created, sort of resurrected some of the study group or the working group to look at some of these, the ideas that came out of this commission, which included the governor's proposal and Representative Hillstrom's proposal on lengthening the sentences for first-degree offenders, but using more of a blended determinate and indeterminate sentencing scheme, and also having a process, as was recommended in the report, to create a sex offender release board so that you could make a decision should these offenders stay in the Department of Corrections facilities for longer periods of time, or should they be civilly committed, or should they be released under intensive supervised release. And so I'll have copies made of this, and I would really encourage members to read the final report. But I'm not going to offer the amendment, but I just wanted to bring that up for discussion. We have some questions. Is this for Mr. Kaplan? Mr. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is going to be quick because I'm not even going to get into debate on what was said on your testimony, but I would like to let the record reflect one specific thing. A reference was made to 4 or 5 years this problem's existed. I've been a county attorney for 32 years prior to coming down here, and I was elected overlapping almost 2006. I was still county attorney 2007. I was here. This problem has existed well before 4 or 5 years, folks, so don't just tell me it's 4 or 5 years. That's the only comment I'm going to make. That referenced only 4 or 5 years of this problem is way off.
Mr. Kaplan, I don't remember what you actually said.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olin, I said at least 4 or 5 years and maybe longer, and that's because I really don't know. It's been a long time, but if I said 10 years, I thought I might get into trouble for that. So I thought it was safer to say 4 or 5 years and maybe longer.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that this body understands that this issue has been one that we've struggled with. I mean, we attempted to do indeterminate sentencing. We thought that they were going to do 144 offenders with indeterminate sentencing, and in fact, we've had 4, I believe is the number, maybe 8. And in fact, this committee financed indeterminate sentencing for 144 folks. And so I think that this recommendation was one of the recommendations in that report. I agree that we need to have a comprehensive approach. I've also got a bill that requires indeterminate sentencing. This is the governor's proposal. This is what he asked for. And so I think it's very appropriate that this committee consider the governor's proposal.
Representative Cornish, did you have a question?
No comment. Mr. Chairman, having figured out already that an amendment to triple the sentences probably wouldn't go in the committee, I'm wondering, after all these comments, what's your prognosis of the bill? What do you really want to do with it? I don't want to see it die. I want to see it law. And what's we going to carve it up, amend it, pass it the way it is, or let it die and not put it on the omnibus? Or what are we going to do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish. Representative Paymire and I have been talking about this bill a lot. We've been, in discussions. I've been in discussions with, REMA, with the department. The Senate made some significant changes, some expanding, some changing in a way that I'm not sure I could live with. So I think we're going to lay it over. We're going to keep talking and see where we go. So we've still got a long time before, session adjourns, and I think we're just going to keep talking. Would that accurately reflect where we are, Representative Paymire?
Absolutely, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Cornish, I really want to deal with this issue. I mean, I think, and you've expressed frustration, we've all expressed frustration that the system, I wouldn't say it's, maybe it is broken, and we need to fix it. And if we don't wrap our arms around it and really figure this out, the governor, the legislature, both bodies, the Department of Corrections, MSOP. When you talk frankly with people, you can see what direction we need to take, and I think we can do it, and we have to do it.
I would just like a commitment from everybody not to talk it to death, is all. So,
no, Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I would just like to indicate that for anybody that thinks my comments were met, that I'm just hardcore and don't want to do anything. We've needed to do something for years and years and years. Before I got down here, when I first came down here, I was thinking I was going to make the bill, but I realized, wait a minute, now I don't know exactly what the groundwork is here, because I'm a first-year person in 4 years ago. So I stayed away from this issue, because I thought there were people here that would probably know more, and there probably are. But I fully agree with a lot of what Representative Paymire is saying. Now, whether I would say everything I agree with exactly on an amendment, it's hard to say, but we certainly do intend to work for this. And my real objection to credit to yours comments were when you say 4 to 5 years, that pinpoints exactly when a prosecutor walked into this facility for the first time in years.
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just astounded at the 90% to 92% of those offending never have done so before. Is that every year?
Of those
Mr.
being adjudicated.
Mr. Kaplan.
Mr. Chair, Representative, on average, if you look at the people that are being adjudicated for a sex crime, 90% to 92% have not had a prior true sex crime conviction. 8% to 10% have. What I mean by a true sex crime conviction is that there was an offense committed, there was an adjudication and a disposition, and then a new offense. You could have someone who was incarcerated for a sex offense, and then conduct which occurred years before the current incarceration is discovered through DNA or whatever, and there's a subsequent prosecution, but the offense actually took place before. As we know, sex offenders typically have a cluster of offenses, not just one offense. So old offenses can also be adjudicated after an offense. So it's on average per year, 90 to 92% of those adjudications are with people that have not had a previous adjudication for a sex crime.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lane.
I'm just looking at it in terms of, are we just putting our finger in the dike hole rather than looking at what is it in society that's got year after year people coming onto the scene new with sex offenses and is trying to throw them. I mean, we've got strong sentences, and it doesn't seem to be stopping it. Is there a larger picture here?
Representative Lane, we had some testimony from MnCASA a few weeks ago on this issue that I think, and Mr. Janis from William Mitchell addressed that, you know, we're putting a lot of money at the back end, which obviously we should, and we need to put some of these offenders away for a long time, and some should be civilly committed and never released because they're a danger to society and they'll continue to prey on children. It's who gets there and how we assess these things, but we're not doing much to prevent sexual violence in our country, and I think we can do a whole lot more, but that's an issue for another day, I guess. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Is it Dr. Kaplan?
Mr. Kaplan.
Mr. Kaplan, you've labeled the notion behind this bill, the notion of sentencing extreme sex offenders, doubling the sentence sexually. Essentially, you've labeled that as not being rationally cohesive. I understand there are studies that show recidivism rate is the same with or without treatment. I don't want to debate you or have another 10 minutes worth of testimony, but if doubling the rate for extreme sex offenders is not a good idea, can you, in a couple sentences, tell me what you do want to do with extreme sex offenders?
Mr. Kaplan.
Chair, Representative Smith, what I'd like to do is see all sex crimes have an indeterminate sentence. I would double the presumptive, or I would have the presumptive sentence as a minimum, and I would double the current statutory maximums. I would have a release board, which is comprised of individuals that are learned and skilled in making release decisions and evaluating whether someone continues to be a risk to the community. So, for example, first-time offender, criminal sexual conduct in the first degree, it would be a 12 to 60 year sentence. And after 12 years, the person could petition for release. They would not necessarily be released. They would have to provide evidence, whether it be through their treatment during incarceration. They would have to show that their risk to the community is acceptably low. And so that's what I mean by lengthening the sentences. And I also think that an approach like, and that was what the recommendation was in the governor's 2005 proposal, commission report. And that's what I mean about identifying those individuals as we do now for civil commitment. I mean, with those low reoffense rates, clearly we know how to assess risk assessment, and a large number of those people are being civilly committed. So I believe that we could identify those people while they're in prison and not have to rely on civil commitment down the road, because you'd have up to a 60-year sentence on a first offender, criminal sexual conduct in the first degree.
That's all. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kukornis, did you have another question or comment?
Mr. Kaplan, I, on the other hand, would love to debate you for an hour, but I... I've had the flu the last couple of days, but what makes my stomach growl more is when you guys keep putting out these facts that are screwed up. Sex offenses are like DWIs. You do about 100 of them before you get caught. These perverts that we're talking about have probably been abusing a relative in the family and got by with it. Sex offenses are the most unreported crime there are, and if people are intimidated and they don't report them, these probably been sitting on ladders, peeking in people's bedroom windows. And on the street, when we pick these people up, it's not their first time, and they deserve a double sentence. When I took a first-time offender into Stillwater State Prison one time, first thing he started to do is waving to his buddies who were already up there. These are in a special class of people that need special treatment, and your facts are just skewered. And you're a good man, and I promise to be easy on the presenters to the committee here, because I get upset when I hear these facts, but they just aren't accurate. These people are getting by with a lot of unreported crimes, and this guy that rapes a girl, it just didn't click into his mind one day, I'm going to go rape somebody. He's led a lifestyle like that, and that's what led him up to it, with a lot of other sex offenses that have gone unreported. So these people can't fit into our norm of sentence scheduling. They have to be set aside a special spot for them. And the victims of these crimes, I think, would disagree with you a lot. They're probably thinking of everything from castration to the death penalty. And so somewhere in between that scale, we have to find a way to deal with these people. And a parole board and release board just doesn't cut it with me and all these philosophical ideas. So I would love to have a conversation about this, but I'd rather err on the side of the victim so that this doesn't happen again. So,
Mr. Chaplin.
Representative Cornish, the offense that you described was, again, what commonly is thought of criminal sexual conduct in the first degree. And that's what I mean by a shotgun approach, a stranger-on-stranger offense. There are many other subdivisions, or I should say subparts to that subdivision, which are offenses that are quite different than that. And that's why I'm saying I think we really need to have a rational fine-tuning of those statutes, so you're going to incarcerate the people that need to be incarcerated and deserve to be incarcerated for longer periods and not incarcerate everybody. I would also argue that if you cannot, and I agree that there's a cluster of offenses typically when an offender, by the time they're apprehended. But I would also argue that if you can't catch a repeat sex offender, then you can't catch anybody. With community notification, DNA testing, sex offender registration, when you know where they're at, if you can't catch those people, then you can't catch anybody.
Representative Cornish.
Well, we catch a lot of them, but sex offenders are one of the hardest to catch because they're good at what they do and keeping it quiet. Yeah, once they got the DNA and we can find the crime that's committed and send that in, but that's not what I'm talking about. So we just have a vast chasm here in our thinking.
Representative Cornish, I hope as we move forward that you would be open to participating in this discussion, because I really think we need a lot of people to fix this, and I hope you'd be willing to do that. Representative Liebling, then Representative Haas, and then we have one more bill that might have a little bit of controversy too, so we should probably get to that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say, Representative Cornish, you know, your concerns, I think, are certainly valid and serious ones, but I think I heard Mr. Kaplan very carefully not use the term first offender. He's talked about previous adjudication. And I think we're talking about, I think, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm hearing that term a recognition that somebody who has not been adjudicated, that doesn't mean they haven't committed offenses. But in terms of public policy, when we're focusing our dollars and our resources on certain people, you know, we seem to be focusing on whether or not somebody's been convicted before, and you know, that's how we're distinguishing between people. And so I think it's important that I think we pretty much all recognize what you're saying, that it isn't necessarily the first adjudication doesn't mean it's the first offense. But, you know, I think he was very careful to make that distinction. The other thing I want to say is that, you know, much as we might, you know, all like to say, let's lock up everybody to make sure that we don't make a mistake by releasing somebody who shouldn't be released,
The reality is that we have limited public dollars. And especially those of you who like to cut government, you know, every dollar we spend on this is a dollar we can't spend on something else. So let's do it in the way that really is the most effective use of our dollars so that we can get the most public safety for our buck. And that doesn't necessarily mean locking up everybody because of this identification problem and a lot of other problems that Mr. Kaplan and others are talking about. I mean, we have to look at a range of strategies, and we have to try to focus our dollars in the way that they will work the best for us. And, you know, we could lock, sure, it's you get safety, you people can't reoffend when they're locked up. I mean, there's no question about that. But then there are lots of other people you're not putting any resources into who will be offending. So we just have to figure all that out. And, you know, I hope that as we try to do this, we can recognize that we all have the same interest in public safety. And there is not one of us who doesn't realize how important this is.
Representative Haas and then Bigham.
Thank you. I agree with a lot of things said at the table. But then I wonder about a society that's creating monsters. And some of these have harmed an awful lot of people. Many of them are caught, as Mr. Cornish says, really hard to catch. I would think there's many of them that have never been caught. And they've left a trail of victims that are haunted throughout their whole life because of that reaction. And then you think, what are we doing in society to put a stop to that? What is it that we need to do to reduce the number of monsters that we have in society? I don't even think the monster wants to be a monster. Most of them, I think, have double personalities or triple personalities so that they can live with themselves. Nobody wins at this. We have civil commitments where people are not getting out. We have one person that got out. I think he's dead now. Well, we got those locked up, but I'll say you got a pot full of monsters in society, harming today, harming tomorrow, and creating that harm for a lifetime of how many people do these perverts hurt in their life? 100? 200? I think what we're doing is fine. Hell, we'll lock them up. But I don't think we've protected society. And I think we got to back down the door and say, how in the hell are we creating monsters like this? And how do we put a stop to it? How do we put one buck into stopping it? That's my little lecture for today.
Thank you. Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was going to say a lot of what Representative Haas said is that there's a lot of victims that leave a trail because it's not reported. And what I hear Representative Cornish saying is they're difficult to, these perverts are difficult to catch because they go unreported. And then you have a trail, just like Representative Haas says. And I think we have to look at the beginning part of it too, Representative Liebling. But when we're talking about money, This actually is going to save us money, and I like this proposal because, you know, I heard the professor from William Mitchell, huge fan of William Mitchell, by the way. If
they're listening.
Yeah. If, you know, talking about how, you know, we have to have a comprehensive look at it, and I agree with Minkasa and all these other organizations, and I'm not going to be here, but I hope you guys do look at this, but This proposal deserves merit, and I wish it was going forward because I think it is a step in the right direction. Because if they are locked up, they're not going to be offending people anymore. And then I think we have to take a look at the programming with Moose Lake. And but the fact of the matter is we have to do this. We should have been doing this a couple of years ago. To be fair, so I hope that. This proceeds, and I hope that you guys do take a comprehensive look at it because it is something that will save us money and save victims.
And members, I just, if you had a chance. Representative Lesh.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And not necessarily one who's always interested in adding to the cacophony that I've heard here already, but Folks should remember that we did do this years ago. In fact, it was 5 years ago that I started writing a change back to indeterminate sentencing. And in the midst of that rewrite action, I worked with Judy Zoller in research on that. In the midst of that, Drew Shedin happened. That was in November. And we were in the minority then. And so Eric Paulson and Kurt Zellers took on the leadership of that bill for the proposed change, and it was championed by the governor at the time. It didn't necessarily go the direction that I wanted it to go specifically, but this has been done time and time again. It's been looked at time and time again. I think that that was a step in the direction. I think Representative Hillstrom's bill is a step in the right direction, but I think if we don't go forward on this without learning from what we've done in the past and tried to do in the past, we're going to be in trouble. So just by way of comment, Representative Hillstrom, I support the direction you're going, and I look forward to seeing the talks that you have, and I look forward to being a part of them.
Thank you, Representative Lash. And again, I really would encourage you to read the Governor's Commission on Sex Offender Policy. It was done only 5 years ago. It's exactly what we should be looking at and building on, and we don't have to recreate the wheel and start a whole new study group to make this happen and talk it to death if we're really serious about it. I would just ask you to look at the fiscal note if you did and if you had not. And, you know, we're basically talking about gradually increasing the offenders in the Department of Corrections to 516, which is a whole new prison. And if you look at the fiscal note, there's no savings to MSOP until we wouldn't see anything until 2016. So it you can sort of see the dilemma we're in here in terms of trying to do this in a balanced way. But Representative Hillstrom, I appreciate you offering the bill, and I commit to this committee that we're not going to let this go away, and that we will be working during the interim on this bill and other good ideas to deal with sex offenses in the state of Minnesota. So with that, we'll lay House File 3081 on the table. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Now your next bill is House File 2990.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 2990 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Full Finance Committee. Mr. Chair, there is an amendment and then an oral amendment to the amendment.
Okay. Is that the A2 amendment?
Correct. And actually, I don't think there's an oral amendment to the amendment. There's an oral amendment to something else. Mr. Chair, the A2 amendment was actually put on this bill in Representative Pawlowski's committee.
So it's on?
However, when the bill came before the House Public Safety Policy Committee, we didn't have the correct engrossment. So we have two engrossments of the bill floating out here. So we're going to just work off the bill that you have and put this amendment on so that we actually have all of the work that's been done on the bill in one copy. In processing the paper, we were moving a lot of bills. We just didn't get the engrossment in time. And so inadvertently, we passed the wrong version. So this A2 amendment actually puts the bill in the shape it was when it left Representative Pawlowski's committee, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom moves the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. That motion prevails. Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, there's an oral amendment on page 6, line 6.8. After the comma, we need to add "and thereafter."
Where is that? Representative Hillstrom, would you repeat that? I was on line 6.8. Are you talking about October 1st?
No, Mr. Chair, on the bill, on line page 6, line 6.8, it says, "and may authorize program expenditures until the board is established, comma, and thereafter." Oh, I have to have the. See, this is the wrong. See, we got two versions of this bill. This is the exact problem.
Okay,
Okay, so now I guess on the version we're working off of now is line 6.14. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. So the board is established, comma, and thereafter.
Okay, does everyone understand the amendment? Everyone? Okay, Representative Hillstrom moves that oral amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this is an initiative of the Judicial Council, and so with me is Sue Dosell, and I would really like her to walk you through what she intends to do.
Ms. Dosell, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Sue Dosell. I am a state court administrator. This bill transfers the guardian ad litem program from the courts to an independent board within the judicial branch, but not under the administrative control of the courts. The reason for this is the a conflict of interest or appearance of conflict of interest of the judiciary appointing and paying for guardians ad litem who are a party to the case before the judiciary. This bill would provide for a new 7-member board that must be appointed by October 1, 2010. The guardian ad litem program has about a $12 million annual budget plus dedicated revenue that comes from reimbursements ordered by the court and paid by the parents. The guardian ad litem program will transfer approximately 220 employees and continue to use some 400 volunteers to support this program under the new board. In FY11, which is the year of transition, the guardian ad litem budget and reimbursements will be transferred to the board. However, my office and judicial districts under the bill would have the authority to continue to make spending decisions as they do now until the board is up and running and feels as if it can begin to assume those decisions itself. But in no event would the courts continue to provide management oversight and decision making and spending beyond June 30 of 2011. In FY12, which would be the beginning of the next biennium, the bill provides for a direct appropriation to this guardian ad litem board of the budget. Now, no new money is being requested for this bill. We believe that the cost of the new board and staff can be borne within the existing budget. To keep costs down, my office and the districts will essentially serve as a fiscal agent for this board as long as they wish us to, which means that we would provide basic administrative services like HR, payroll, and accounting and the like, and do so during the transition and beyond as long as the board would request us to do that. Of course, the new board will make the ultimate decisions about any changes to the current organization of the program and staffing and how it's structured and so forth. But for purposes of this transfer and this bill, we estimate that the cost for the new board, its operations and some central staff as well as technology, would be about $900,000, or about 7% of the budget. About $500,000 for staff, about 5 positions, we believe, a program administrator that's provided in the bill, as well as administrative assistant, a couple of staff attorneys, and a program analyst. To handle things like program and employee supervision of this very large and complex program, performance measurements, board support, legal advice to the guardians ad litem, handling issues relating to rules changes, program standards, doing contracts, training, legislative policy and budget work, complaint investigation and resolution, among many other responsibilities. In addition, we estimate a cost of about $400,000 for technology. We had hoped that the board could operate under the judicial branch software licenses, but unfortunately, legally, we cannot do that. So the technology will be a cost of this separation. The majority of these costs will be paid for, can be paid for by the reimbursement funding. It's about $600,000 annually. We are confident that the remainder of the cost can be found through efficiencies in the program. Things like working with judges in family law to ensure more focused orders regarding the guardian ad litem assignment to make sure that they're only the number of the duties that are needed in those cases are actually those that are performed by the guardian ad litem. Developing stronger protocols to discharge guardians ad litem as soon as appropriate. Increased use of technology like Skype and ITV for meetings and training to avoid travel time and cost. Increased volunteer support for attorney representation, expert witness support, and consultation and training services. And if need be, to reduce the number of non-mandated GAL appointments that are now being made in family law. You may recall that a number of years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, the legislature repealed the requirement that counties provide custody evaluation services for the courts. The counties got out of that business. The courts have been left with high conflict divorce situations involving children, and as the last resort, not having any other resources to figure out, you know, he said, she said, they have been appointing guardians ad litem. Guardians ad litem are not fully trained in this area, and this would be something that, if need be, could be reduced. So it's our strong view that this transfer can be made. We think it is the right thing to do on the policy grounds, and that there are sufficient funds and efficiencies to deal within its $12 million annual budget, plus on average about $600,000 a year in reimbursements to handle this, absorb this new cost to the board.
Questions of Mr. Sal, Representative Ward, and then Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sal, Representative Elston, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I've spent a significant amount of time, Mr. Sal, on the guardian ad litem issue. And it's guardian ad litem do a remarkable job. I mean, they have a very frustrating, very difficult, but very important and very needed job. And one of the main things that I hear criticism on the guardian ad litem program is exactly the conflict of interest. And I really believe this piece of legislation is going to resolve a lot of concerns and problems within that guardian ad litem program and move a program forward that will even be better. So thank you for this.
Good. Thank you.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the author and the testifier, a couple areas of questions. You testified that after the transition period, the costs for support, payroll, accounting, HR, whatever, would be paid for by the reimbursement funding and efficiencies. Let me back up. You said that it would be provided, first of all, as long as the board requests it. Where in the bill does it say that?
Mr. Saul or Representative Hillstrom?
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, if you look at,
Representative Hillstrom. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's where we added the words "and thereafter."
Right.
Okay. So lines.
Line 6.14.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, also the testimony was that any costs that arise as a result of this for the board would be paid for by reimbursement funding or expected efficiencies. If this is a new board starting up, why can't we expect that it's going to have all the efficiencies it's going to need? And therefore, if it does, and there's additional costs needed, will that simply just deplete their existing budget to have to meet those costs?
Mr. Saul.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, two answers to that. One, this program has continued to evolve. and improve over time, and it has a ways yet to go. Some of the strategies that I just talked about are ones that are being developed as a result of the, you know, budget constraints. The other issue that is happening is that the program is moving now from primarily independent contractors and volunteers to an employee model. We believe that while we have tried for a number of years to use independent contractors, that this kind of a program involving cases that engender the most emotion of any kind that we handle, and with high conflict parties that may stand to lose their children, that they need the maximum amount of training and oversight and supervision, and that's not possible with independent contractors. And so we're moving to that now as a strategy to improve the quality and the productivity of our guardians ad litem, and that is not yet done. This will be part of the efficiencies that we will realize. So I think we feel very confident that the relatively small gap, $300,000, out of this $12 million budget can be handled through these strategies.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that. One other area I have a question in is with regard to the structure and makeup of the membership of the board. The language only seems to indicate that the candidate should demonstrate an interest in maintaining, and I'm reading from it now on page 3, maintaining a high quality independent guardian ad litem program, etc. Just because you're looking at folks demonstrating an interest, it really doesn't mean that they have any knowledge of the day-to-day workings or operations of the existing program, nor that they even have the best interests of children in mind. Was there any thought given to requiring a specific inclusion of a number of guardian ad litems on the board for membership? And if not, why not?
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me start by saying that this was modeled after the Public Defense Board is where this model came from. And in fact, I have been lobbied, as I'm sure you have, received letters as well saying that guardians should be on the board. One of the groups that is lobbying actually are the contract lobbyists who the court is talking about eliminating and moving to an employee model. But I have received more than 12 entities requesting to be specifically named on the board. And so the goal was to have a board and then to have an advisory group who makes recommendations to the board. But if I named every single entity that has asked me to be specifically named on the board, we would have a very unmanageable board. So I have stayed away from all of that. And we have also said that on page 3, line 27, that the candidates shall be well acquainted with the guardian ad litem program as well as laws that affect guardian ad litem work, including the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act and these other issues. So we did start to outline the other areas of expertise that they needed to have as well.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, just in closing, I haven't received a number of letters on this very topic. We on our side of the fence, as a result of a recent news conference, are getting a number of emails on a whole different issue, to the tune of several hundred. So, but I have received one contact from a guardian ad litem who is a constituent, and that person did in fact point out the argument that you made about modeling it after the Board of Public Defense. But this individual pointed out that there is a difference. The Board of Public Defense is made up of lawyers. The Guardian Ad Litem program is not. It's made up of people who have an interest in the best interests of the children. So of the seven members, I would suggest, you know, you don't have to include pipe fitters and lawyers and doctors and 50 different professions, but it would have been nice to carve out at least one seat as a requirement that they be a guardian ad litem.
Mr. Sell, and then we do have a, I would like to give an opportunity for people to address the bill in the audience. So, Mr. Sell, do you want to respond to that?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator and Representative Smith, I think the point is that the makeup of the board is seven persons, three appointed by the governor, three appointed by the Supreme Court, two of whom must be lawyers, four appointed by the governor. There's nothing in terms of their background that's required. There's nothing in this that does not that would preclude a guardian ad litem or a former guardian ad litem to be appointed to this board. And we would expect that there would be people that would come forward and ask to be considered.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I have been requested to place two guardian ad litems on the board, one contract and one employee. So that's been the request that's been made of me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Is there anyone that would like to address the committee on this bill? Please come forward. Thank you. If you'd please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Virginia Rudloff, and I am the director of CASA Minnesota, a nonprofit organization that provides support to the volunteer guardian ad litem programs. And I'm also a volunteer guardian ad litem. The state court has said that this bill is fiscally neutral, and at face value, it is. However, the state court plans to pay for the creation of this board with funds from the existing guardian ad litem budget, a budget that does not currently include funds for the staff that will work with this board. According to a report from the state court's independent agency work group, it could cost as little as $500,000 to as much as $2.7 million in additional money to fund the creation of this board and pay for support services. And as far as I know, the guardian ad litem program will also be taking the same cuts that the rest of the trial court budget will take this year and next. Additionally, if state and district court administrations pull their support services in July 2011, and the bill states that it may provide these services, it does not say that it shall, it could come up with the additional money for offices, accounting and HR services, legal services, IT services, office equipment, and other expenses not currently in the guardian ad litem budget. Most guardians ad litem work out of their homes, and unless the guardian ad litem programs can come up with office space, they will also have to pay stipends for in-home offices. We may not be able to absorb these cuts if the program was not underfunded in the first place. Back in 1998, the court's guardian ad litem subcommittee recommended a $25 million budget for the guardian ad litem program. The state court asked for less than half that amount. Our programs are very worried about the possible reduction of services to children. At the same time that the court has decided to transition its contractor guardians ad litem to employee guardians ad litem without any addition to the guardian ad litem budget. In order to pay the benefits for these employee guardians ad litem, their programs will lose up to one-third of their current guardians ad litem. The guardian ad litem budget is already stressed to the maximum, and now it must somehow absorb the cost of creating and staffing a new board and the conversion to employees. I believe that the program staff is worried about the financial ramifications of this conversion, which doesn't occur until July 1st, 2010. So we know nothing about any of the unanticipated costs or outcomes at this time. The state court says this legislation is based on the legislation which created the Public Defender Board of Defense. It is almost exactly word for word. There is one big difference between this bill and the Public Defender's Bill. The Bill of Public Defense is governed by a majority of attorneys. The Guardian Ad Litem Bill does not guarantee the appointment of any guardians ad litem, and the state court has declined to add that language to the bill, stating that the guardians ad litem are welcome to apply and that it is anticipated that the guardians ad litem will serve on the board's advisory committee, which, by the way, sunsets out in 2014. It is easily conceivable that the guardian ad litem program will be run by people who have never walked in a guardians ad litem shoes, have never had any experience with the day-to-day operation of a guardian ad litem program. I fear that if you pass this bill, the guardian ad litem program will be back at the legislature in 2011 begging for more money just to stay alive. There will be fewer guardians ad litem serving larger numbers of children with less administrative oversight. The abused and neglected children of Minnesota have already been dealt a bad hand. Please don't make it worse. The decision to move the guardian ad litem program out of the state court seems hasty at best and should require a more careful accounting of the costs of running a statewide guardian ad litem program with the addition of its new administrative structure. The Guardian Ad Litem Advisory Committee and the Judicial Council both urged the court to come up with a solution that does not harm children. This bill is an easy way out. It does not consider the consequences to children.
Thank you, Ms. Rudlaw. Any questions of the testifier? Representative Hillstrom, do you want to respond at least the transitional costs that Ms. Rudlaw spoke about, the $500,000 to, I believe you said, up to $2 million. Was that accurate? Was that your testimony, Ms. Rudlaw?
Yes.
That you think that that's how much the transition will cost to
that's
create
the guardian ad litem, or the work group for the state court said it would cost.
Mr. Saul, do you want to respond to that, please? Just so, I mean,
Mr. Chair, the span from 500,000 to 2.7 would be depend on how it was organized, and how we got it to the 900,000 is the continuing support that the courts will provide, serving as the fiscal agent, providing free space wherever possible and the like. So that's where we're at, the 900,000, and as I testified, I believe that we feel confident that that can be dealt with within the existing budget.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so members know, I learned early on that there was a positive fund balance in these funds, and before I knew that, I was looking at it for something else, and I think it's very appropriate that some of these fund balances that are out there, that are fees collected when guardian ad litems are used, be used to make this transition.
Any questions? Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the testimony was previously the budget request was $25 million. Is that what I understood back in 2006 or something from the courts? And now we're suggesting that it'll that the budget be $12 million. I'm just maybe correct me if I'm wrong.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that everyone makes recommendations about how much money they need, and then that goes to the Judicial Council, and then the Judicial Council makes a decision about how much money to ask the legislature for. And so that particular program did ask for that amount of money, but when the court came to ask the legislature for money, it did not ask for that amount of money.
Representative Kelly.
Okay. Oh, that clears up. Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom, anything else?
That's it, Mr. Chair.
So Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 2990, First Engrossment, as amended, be approved and referred to the Finance Committee. Any discussion on that motion? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Members, before you leave, I need a motion to approve the minutes for Tuesday, March 23rd. Representative Ward moves that motion. For Tuesday, March 23rd, Representative Ward moves that motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Members, one more final thing here. I believe this will be our final meeting. And I would just like to thank you all for your participation in this difficult time making budget reductions in an area that I don't think anybody wants to make any budget reductions. And I really appreciate all your input on both sides of the aisle. And I'd also like to specifically thank my committee administrator, who's just done a bang-up job, Libby Wyrum, and Lisa Gonzalez, who's new to staff, who's been just a wonderful addition, and of course Gary, Jeff, and Becky, and Dennis and Kate for your help making this committee work smoothly. So thank you all very much. This meeting's adjourned.